now that we've designed the chain, we need to do the next step, which is we've got to install the chain. Now, installing the chain is actually pretty straightforward. It's just a mechanical process of using a sequence of collapsed anchors. Here's how you do it. Step one is you're not going to actually, but this time you're not going to start with the problem state, or you could start anchoring the problem state right at the beginning before you even design the chain. You don't want to anchor the state, the problem state, state one, after you've designed the chain. And the reason for that is you don't want to confuse the unconscious mind too much. So you either anchor the problem state, state one, right at the beginning before you even go into the state design, or you leave it right at the end before you actually run the chain. It doesn't matter which. For the moment, I'm going to assume you haven't anchored it at the beginning. You've just gone straight into designing the chain. So you know your five steps, which are depression, relaxed but not particularly positive, contented, happy, and then finally excited and motivated. You've designed the chain, but you've not anchored anything yet. So your starting point is going to be state two, which in our example is relaxed but not particularly positive. So you're now going to do a straightforward elicitation and a straightforward simple anchor, as you've learned already in the previous session, session three. So you elicit that state, you build it up until it's nice and, you know, it's taken over the neurology, and you anchor it. Now, when you're anchoring it, you want to make sure you have a sequence of anchors that you can run in a chain. So for example, let's say you're going to use the leg or the shoulders as a place to anchor all these five states. So you may start with a position by the knee being state one. You may choose a position a little bit further up being state two, halfway up the thigh being state three, further up being state four, and all the way up by the top by the hip being step five, right? And you want to make sure that those are easily accessible, because in a moment you're going to basically be activating one after the other in a chain, hence chaining anchors. You also want to make sure that if you're going to use a physical chain in that sense, that you use the correct hand at each step, so that you can constantly swap hands. So for example, let's say the right hand goes into step onto the knee for step one, then the left hand will be on step two, then the right hand will come back into play for state three, then the left hand will come back to state four, and the right hand will be state five. So you're constantly changing hands. What you don't want to have, for example, is state two and state three being anchored with the left hand at some part of the thigh, for example, because you won't be able to fire state two and state three at the same time if it's the left hand doing it. Does that make sense to you so far?
Yep.
Okay, so let's go back to the installation. You have chosen what anchors you're going to use for each step of each state. You have chosen the way you're going to do it. You've chosen the hands. You know that they can run smoothly, so you can actually create all the chains and run them after the other. Then you elicit state two, you anchor it. You elicit state three, you anchor that, break a state. You elicit state four, you anchor that, you break the state. You elicit state five, which is the resource state, the ultimate excitement and enthusiasm. You elicit that, you anchor it, you break the state. So now you have relaxed but not particularly positive, you have contented, you have happy, and you have excited and motivated, all anchored. Now that you've got all those anchored, you're going to go right back to step one, which is the first state, and you've left the place right at the top of, say, the knee, before all the other states, to be able to anchor that one in. You go back to the problem, you elicit that, you anchor it, that's step, state one now. And once you've anchored state one, you break the state, you have now all the elements of the chain ready to go. So you have all five states anchored in different parts of, say, the thigh or the leg, with different anchors which you can run one after the other. Now you're going to run the chain, and as the name implies, you're going to literally run a chain of collapses. So you'll start off with a problem, just like in collapse anchors, and you're going to start with state one, and then you're going to collapse state two into it, just as you did a moment ago with the collapse anchors. So it's going to be normal collapse anchors. As you see, the problem state collapsing into the state two, so state one is collapsing and state two is beginning to be dominant. You release state one, so now state two is on its own. You take your hand over and you now release state three. So now state two and state three are running concurrently. So now a new integration takes place. When you see state two collapsing and state three becoming more dominant and starting to settle down, you release state two, so now state three is on its own. you fire off anchor number 4, state 4. So now state 3 and state 4 are both running concurrently. Again, you observe and wait for the integration to take place. As state 3 begins to collapse and state 4 begins to become dominant, you release state 3. You move your hand over and move it to state 5. So state 4 was briefly on its own, and now you release state 5, so you now have 4 and 5 being fired off concurrently. Again, you watch the integration. As the state 4 collapses and state 5 starts winning out, we release state 4, and now step 5 is on its own. So now you've basically created the chain. So that's step 1 leads step 2, state 2 to state 3, state 3 to state 4, state 4 to state 5. And it's a nice simple chain run through so far. Do you get that process?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Now, you want to condition the chain. Because it's a little bit more complex than the collapse anchors, the chain may have run, it may not. So you're now going to run through the same sequence 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 times. 5 is a pretty good magic number on this one. So what do? You go fire state 1, hold it, go straight to state 2, hold it, go straight to state 3, hold it, go straight to state 4, hold it, go straight to state 5. Notice how this takes a lot less time. The first round, I was waiting for the integration. This time I'm just going fire state 1, I notice something happening, I begin straight into state 2, I release step 1, go straight into state 3, release state 4, 5. So I'm beginning to watch for what's happening in the neurology, and you'll probably notice that it's happening a lot quicker because they already know how to start, run the chain. Again, when you fire step 5 and it's clearly firing, you release that and you break the state. So now they're in a break state, they're back in a neutral state, and you go again. State 1, state 2, state 3, state 4, state 5. Clear the mind, start again. State 1, state 2, state 3, state 4, state 5. Again, clear the mind. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And again, clear the mind. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And again, clear the mind. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And again, clear the mind. This time, you fire off state 1, and you tell them, in other words, it's a direct suggestion, and fire the rest of the chain on your own, or do the rest of the chain on your own. And you watch them go from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 until you basically see their whole neurology getting more positive, more animated, until they're sitting there in step 5, eyes bright, full of energy and enthusiasm, but you're still firing off step 1. Your anchor is still on state 1. So now state 1, your anchor for state 1, which was a problem state, has fired off the whole chain in a sequence, and you can watch the whole sequence happening. At which point you test it, you break the state, you test it, and you future pace it in exactly the same way as you did for a collapse anchors. Does the chaining anchor, the design, the installation, and the running of the chain, do all those steps make sense to you?
Yeah, they do.
Very good. Right, let's move on now to the next anchoring technique. This one's called change personal history. Now, change personal history is basically based around a simple principle, a simple idea. That is to say that as we grow up in life, bad things happen to us, as well as good, and the negative things can have a tendency to hold us back. In other words, if something negative happened to you in your past, it can be the cause of a present limitation, a present belief, a present fear or anxiety or awkwardness or whatever it is. So something in your past has happened, and You know, people sometimes say this, I wish you could go back and change it. Well, change personal history does exactly that. It allows you to go back into your past and change it so that you now have an alternative past in your past history, which you can base your present and your future on. So you basically get rid of problems in that way. To do this is very straightforward. You're going to use the problem state as a somatic bridge back towards the initial historical event that had caused a problem. A somatic bridge basically takes advantage of the idea of state-dependent learning, so that when you're in a particular state, imagine states to be like rooms inside the mind. So when you're in the unhappy room, all your unhappy memories are stored there, which means that your first unhappy memory is also stored there. So whatever caused the unhappiness in this situation is in that room, and by entering the room, you can kind of follow the path back to the original memory, and that's what you're going to do. Here's how to do it. As in the other anchoring techniques, your starting point is basically to find the problem state, the problem anchor, that you'll know it because they'll be talking about it right there and then, and you anchor it. Let's call this anchor 1, P1. P1 is the problem state in the present moment. Now, you want them to follow that feeling back into the past so they can start tracing other events where they felt the same way. Those other events are basically going to be the events that cemented this problem over the course of time so that they end up being in the position they're in now in the present day. So this time, rather than clearing the mind and breaking the state, you can actually fire the problem state, and you're going to say to them something like, follow this state back inside your mind, and you'll notice that you begin to remember other times, other experiences, when you felt the same way. This is the key thing. So you'll notice that you start remembering spontaneously other times or other experiences when you felt this way. So you're firing the problem anchor, P1 at this time. Now, as this is happening, they will go backwards in time, they'll start thinking about events, and they'll spontaneously start saying, oh yeah, I've got one now, I've got one now, right? Or you want to calibrate them and you watch them, and you'll say, you know, what happened then? And it goes, oh, I have one now, right? Whenever a new event comes up, you want to create a new anchor for that. So they'll have one, say they'll have a memory from when they were 18. You anchor that, and that becomes now your second anchor, P2. Then they might, you go back again, you begin with problem one again, P1 being the original problem. You fire that, you go past P2, and you might have something now coming up from when they were 15. It's P3, you anchor that. They'll go back to when they were 12. That's P4, you anchor that. Then we were 8, P5, you anchor that. So you keep going back until the very earliest memory they can get hold of. And you can collect a whole bunch of anchors this way. You may be 3 or 4, you may be 5 or 6, you may be 10 or 12. It really doesn't matter. You just keep tracing it back until they literally have no more early memories coming through. Very often, it'll be roundabouts the age of somewhere between 2 and 5 that they'll have the earliest memory. It's not always the case. Sometimes it stops in the teenage years. Sometimes it goes, you know, back to 1 or something like that. Don't concern yourself too much. Just realize that roundabouts the age of 2 to 5 is where most initial problem events will have started. That's kind of the seed which grew over time. So, and remember, of course, that at each event, you're going to go right back and start again with the original P1, the original problem anchor, tracing it back. So now let's say that you have 5 anchors. You have the original anchor, which is what they came in with, that's P1, and you have 4 events in their history, 18, 15, 12, and 8, that they've traced back. So you now have P1 is the original problem, P2 is going to be 18, P3 is going to be 15, P4 is going to be 12, P8 is going to be 8 years old. So you now have all the problems and ready. You bring them back, break the state, distract them, make sure that they're in a nice, comfortable state of mind again. You've now dealt with the problem side of things for the moment. The next step is to, just like in the normal simple anchoring, is to find a resource. And in the same way as you saw me do with Sean or Nathan, where we did it with in session 3, you're going to find some resources that, and this is important, resources that had you had those resources in the past, you would have been different during those significant events, and you could have felt different about yourself, you could have handled them differently, you could have handled yourself differently, and things would have turned out better. So that resource we're going to call R1, that's going to be your resource state. The key thing here is to make sure the resource is strong enough so that had they had that resource, it could be, say, confidence, it could have been mental alacrity, it could have been sensitivity to others, whatever it is, the key thing is that if they have that resource in those previous times, then the situation would have unfolded differently because they wouldn't have, let's say they had more confidence, they wouldn't have had people walk all over them. Let's say the resource is to be more sensitive to other people, well then they wouldn't have blundered in and said the wrong thing and hurt other people by accident because they were too clumsy in their sensitivities or whatever. It may be more elegance in expressing themselves. Again, it doesn't matter what the resource is. You find it, you revivify a moment in a time when they had a lot of that resource. You intensify it. If you have to stack up some more resources, that's fine too. You have your resource anchor, R1. So now you have six anchors. You have P1, the original problem, P2, 18 years old, P3, which is 15 years old, P4, which is 12 years old, P5, which was at 8 years old, and you have your resource state. You now have everything you need to do a change personal history. Very simply, what you're going to do is you're going to take them back to the very earliest event, which is to say, in this case, we're talking about P5, when they were 8 years old. So you get them to close their eyes. This is where the hypnotics are already beginning. You now fire off P5. And you remind them, you know, you're 8 years old in the situation. And now you do a straightforward collapse anchors with the resource. So just as they're beginning to access P5, 8 years old with the problem, whatever it is, just as they begin to access, and again, remember, a collapse anchors happens before the problem has activated completely, it just begins to activate. So just as you see them getting into the problem, you fire resource one, the main resource. Okay? So you have P5, 8 years old, and the main resource firing at the same time now. Notice, I did not say that they have to remember being 8 years old. They may not actually be able, they may not have enough time to remember the full set of events before they start beginning to feel bad, and that's when the resource comes in. So you're looking, you're calibrating for the beginning of P5, the state to start arising. So they start frowning, start getting anxious, whatever it is. And as they begin to feel that way, you start firing the resource. And all instantly, the resource and the problem, P5, begin to collapse into each other. You do a straightforward collapse anchors. You watch the integration take place, and just as the integration starts panning out and everything starts settling down, you release the problem state, you hold on to resource a moment longer, then you let go, and they sit there feeling great. Okay? Now, when they've collapsed, in other words, P5 has collapsed completely and they're all good and happy, you now go straight on to P4. Again, now you move your anchor to P4. You've let go already of the resource anchor, so they're just in a general happy state. You now fire off P4, which was when they're 12 years old, and you wait for them to begin to start feeling bad again. You begin to see their physiology change and start going into the problem. Just as they begin that whole process, you fire off the resource again. So now P4 and the resource are being collapsed. A straightforward collapse anchors. You watch the integration take place. You remove P4, you allow the resource to be there a moment longer, they're happy, they're content, they're confident, whatever the resource is. Now you move forward into the next one, P3. You do the same thing again, another collapse anchors. Until it starts integrating, you let go of it, they're back in the normal resource again. P2, again, you do a collapse anchors on that. And finally, P1. Now you do a collapse anchors on P1, which was the original problem they were talking about, and you do the resource, you do a straightforward collapse anchors, and now you have done a collapse anchors with your main resource state on each one of those significant events in their history, all the way from being 8 years old to the present day. Now, you do your test. How do you do your test? Very simply put, you just ask them to go back in time and remember those past events and watch what happens naturally. Now, typically, one of several things will happen. One thing that might happen is that they will spontaneously reconstruct the memory in the positive sense. In other words, they'll look at the old event and it starts unfolding itself, as it should have done had they felt more confident or whatever the resource was. So they'll start saying to you, wow, this is weird because, you know, I'm 8 years old and instead of the, you know, the other kids bullying me, I stood up for myself and they left me alone. So they've literally changed their personal history. An alternative of what might happen is they go back to the past and have kind of a dual sense of what could have happened. The past event is still as it is, but they also have a sense of what could have happened and an all-encompassing sense of it really wasn't important anymore. So they could still see the bully there doing their thing, and it just doesn't affect them. They see the bully and they're going, well, you know, it happened, it's not a great thing, but it doesn't really matter. I'm stronger now as a person. I learned all these wonderful lessons and, you know, I'm a better person for it. So whichever it is, whether they spontaneously revise the history or whether they just become unaffected by the history, either way is better. The history has been, their personal history has been changed. So that's the test phase. Then the future pace is very simple. You just orient them towards the future, towards a moment when the problem would normally have arisen. And again, watch it, what let it happen spontaneously. Let's say they came into you because they felt that the boss was bullying them, they couldn't stand up to them. And you did the whole change personal history on that. So they started off being bullied by some kid in a playground when they were 8, then they got bullied in school, then they got bullied, you know, later on in life by classmates and by someone else. Let's say you dealt with all those events and they've gone past and they spontaneously recreated their past and, you know, all those events are fine. But you still have to deal with the boss's face, the boss coming in and trying to bully them. So now you go to the future and go, well, you know, there's going to be a time in the future when you're going to meet your boss, right? You know, probably tomorrow when you go back to work, right? And, you know, chances are sometime sooner or later, maybe tomorrow, maybe next week, he's going to have that look on his face which tells you, uh-oh, you're in trouble now and you're in for it, right? So just notice what happens now. So basically you're doing a future pace and a test. Notice, or rather, you're getting them to notice that the boss starting their bullying behavior is empowering them now, and as a result, instead of, you know, cringing and just taking it, they stand up for themselves, or they do a complaints procedure, or they do whatever spontaneously seems appropriate at that time to deal with the situation. Now what you've done, and this is very important, you've converted the state into a behavioral response, but the future pace has done that spontaneously. So, does the whole change personal history process make sense to you?
Yeah, it does.
Any questions so far? So we've done collapse anchors, chaining anchors, and change personal history. Any questions on those three anchoring processes?
Not so far, no.
Okay. Let's move on to the next technique based on anchoring. This is called the re-imprint method. Now, the re-imprint method is very similar to change personal history, but it has an important difference. Basically, you're going to involve an overt form of reframing as well as the whole resource thing. Now, when would you use a re-imprint, when would you use a change personal history? Change personal history is straightforward and it's direct, and if it works, great. Sometimes, however, you'll find that when it comes time to start collapsing your anchors, in other words, you go back to P5 and you do P5 and your resource state, and you begin to have this struggle. So in other words, the integration just can't take place properly. At that point, or if you anticipate it's likely to happen, for example, for bigger issues, for example, like abuse or, you know, something more traumatic, you may think that you want to have a little bit more going for you, a little bit more backup than just the anchor. Although you can actually do anything just with anchoring as well, of course. At this point, you may choose to use the re-imprint and basically do a kind of a reframe and a parts negotiation along the way. So let me talk about what we mean by reframing and parts negotiations. Remember back to session one, we talked about the first, second, and third position. And if you think back to like an old argument or an old relationship, and you look at it from your own point of view, and you imagine seeing it from the other person's point of view, everything changes. If you see it again from a third person's point of view, in other words, a neutral stranger watching you to interact, they again see the whole thing from a very different perspective. And all that gives you more information, and very often people start having these insights as to why a problem arose, and it's just because, you know, two people miscommunicated or didn't take account of each other's needs, and they realize that the argument need never have happened in the first place. Now, taking this idea of both resources but also the idea that different people, you know, need different things, have different needs, have different intentions, and, you know, they're just doing the best they can with the resource they have, you can then start helping someone go back to a traumatic past. Let's say it's something harsh like an abuse. Let's say someone was physically abused, beaten around by a parent when they were young, and just doing a change personal history, just getting them resourceful won't cut it. They need to be able to let go of that event with more insight. At that point, you want to do basically a kind of a negotiation between the players. Think of it this way. Imagine you could go back in time. You see things from your point of view. But then you start seeing it from someone else's point of view. Let's say someone is being physically abused. And let's use the NLP presupposition to separate intention from behavior. The behavior, beating their child around, is not necessarily positive. But what is a intention, a positive intention that that person might be trying to reach towards, even though the behavior is not a good behavior to do that? So what intention might someone be driven by when they are beating up their child? A positive intention, by the way.
If they just can't cope with, say, their life, and you know, the child wouldn't be quiet, kept crying and things like this, it could just be one of frustration, just trying to sort of gain some control over the situation.
So they feel out of control with life, and the only way they can feel in control is by maybe dominating the child, or picking it. Maybe the child has kind of pulled the final straw and they just snapped. Not to say that they're doing the right thing, but they're just basically, they want peace of mind. They're looking for peace of mind. And somehow that desire to look for peace of mind, which is a positive intention, has got itself warped and mistranslated into a behavior, which is beating the child, right? So behavior is not to be condoned. It's not a good behavior. It's not a positive behavior. But yet, the intention behind it, the peace of mind, is a good thing, right? And had that person had the peace of mind in the first place, chances are they would never have done the whole physical abuse, the whole beating of the child, right?
Yep.
Okay. And this is going to be a key thing that we're going to be using in terms of leverage for the re-imprint method. So, using that as our base assumption, the intention is always positive, the behavior is not necessarily positive, and realizing that we can see any interaction, any event in the past from different points of view, from the, you know, your own point of view at the time, from, say, the other person's, the, in this case, the abuser, as well as from a neutral third-person perspective, just watching the situation, like you're watching a cinema film. And in each position, you'll get a different sense of what's going on, and realizing that different people have different needs, etc. We're going to use all this as a really powerful piece of change work. And this is actually a very, very powerful technique. It takes some time to do properly, or at least it can take some time to do properly, but it is very, very powerful to do. So what's the first step? As in most NLP techniques, the first step is identify the problem, right? Find the recent experience which is negative. Let's say right now that they are feeling worthless. Let's say they come in with a real self-esteem issue. They feel like they're worthless, bad people, right? So you start off in exactly the same way as in the change personal history. So you get the problem state, P1, which is the, you know, right now I'm feeling worthless. You trace it back over the somatic bridge through, you know, 18, 15, 12, 8, etc., different experiences. Now, chances are some of them will be, you know, other people, you know, mistreating them as well, and they're accepting it. But eventually you'll get to the root cause, which will be, for the argument's sake now, be, you know, dad comes home and they pester them, and then dad gets angry and hits them, right? So far, it looks like a normal change personal history. You've anchored P1, P2, P3, P4, P5, just as before. And then you've brought them back to the present state, you've broken the state, you've dissociated them, you've got them out of all that problem, and you come back to the present moment in time, right? Now you're going to start identifying some resources, some personal resources for the person, just like in change personal history. Only this time, when you go back into into P5, rather than doing a simple collapse anchors as you would do in change personal history, you're going to start doing basically what's called a parts negotiation. You're going to do a little bit of parts therapy. Each of the players in that scene, let's say in this scene it's just the person and their father. They are a different part. That father figure in that memory isn't actually the real person, isn't actually the real dad who might have passed away ages ago, who may have no contact with the child anymore, or maybe still has contact with the person. That person, that memory, is rather that part of the neurology that the person is identified with. So it's actually, they're just dealing with parts of themselves that are splintered off, and they don't know how to interact with or don't accept. So you need to basically reintegrate that part into the person Think of it as a part of them has come splintered off and become frozen like a sliver of ice. And you've got to melt the sliver of ice so that that water can rejoin the rest of the pool and blend with the rest of the pool so that all the resources and all the person's abilities all abound and are together at the same time, right? So how do we do this? Well, we begin by going all the way back to P5. So you use your anchor, P5, to send them back to 8 years old. You know, dad is there reading the paper, gets frustrated and hits the child. Now, before the event plays out fully, you're going to get the person, the client, to dissociate. You're going to get them to dissociate by imagining that they're floating out of the child's body, so that they're maybe up in the ceiling or up in the stratosphere looking down at the house with that little kid over there and the little, you know, person representing the father. So they're watching it from a third point of person's point of view, you know, the dissociated point of view. Now, there are many ways you can do this. You can do it like a fly on the wall, you know, just watching the scene. If that's too close for the individual, you may want to lift them up and maybe imagine that it's a cinema and they're sitting in the back of the cinema screen looking down at the screen all the way down there. And use your language, by the way. Remember we used about presupposition, all the way down there, implying that there's a lot of distance, a lot of emotional distance as well. You could get them to float up into outer space and look down at that tiny planet and know that there's a tiny house there and see the tiny little, you know, person that's the younger them and the tiny little person that's the parent. So it just puts into a lot more perspective that way, right? Other things you can do to create more dissociation so that they don't feel the emotions as strongly is you could imagine you can get them to slide a plexiglass screen, like a bulletproof screen, that protects them or shields them from the emotional event, right? So these are all different devices, metaphorical devices, to basically say, take a step back from the situation and look at it dispassionately, without the emotions. Do you see how that dissociation works? Whether you get them to float up and be a fly on the wall, whether it's, you know, further out in space, whether it's imagining that they're in a cinema looking at the screen where the actors are playing out that scene, whether you put a bulletproof safety screen between them and the screen so that they have even more distance. These are all just different metaphors, basically saying, get back, get some distance, don't get involved, but be able to see it on a more dissociated, dispassionate sort of way. Does all that kind of make sense so far?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, now, this is very important. Remember we talked about intention and behavior. We need to separate one from the other. So you need to now chunk up on the intention of all the players involved. So what do we mean by this? Well, actually, let me just make one more point. When they dissociate, for example, let's say they're using the cinema screen technique, so they float out of the child, they explode into a cinema where they're watching the scene of the child and the parent on a silver screen, maybe just a black and white screen so it's more distant, and you make it small and dark in the corner to get even more distance. You probably want to anchor that. You call it the dissociation anchor, just so that you can bring them back to this place. If they find themselves being sucked into the event, you can just anchor them back and pull them back out into the cinema so they don't fall into the scene by accident. Because sometimes that can happen. Sometimes when they dissociate, you start asking questions about the event, they may just reassociate, they may go back into the emotion, and then you just want to use the anchor to just pull them back out of it again. That's just a little safety tip. So, now that they are watching the scene, they're dispassionate, they can watch it, you know, with a detached point of view, what you want to do is you want to chunk up on the intention. You're going to start off with the actual younger them. So the 8-year-old boy, you're going to start off and find out what the intention was in terms of them behaving the way that they did. Always go for the highest positive intention. So let's say that the young client sits there and he gets beaten and he's crying, right? So you can just find out, what was his intention the whole interaction? Why was he being loud in the first place? You know, what was driving that whole behavior that started it all off? And maybe it was just like the intention was just to have, you know, get some love from the parent. It's a great positive intention, right? Remember, we're not talking anything about behavior. We're not saying that the child acted wrongly by being loud. We're not saying that there are better ways of dealing with it. Nothing. All we care about right now is the child, his intention is to get some love from the parent. Great. Now we turn our attention to the other players in the scene. In this example, we just have two people. We have the parent and the child, the father and the child. So now you turn to the parent and you find out what is the positive intention, for that person. Now at this point, you're probably going to need to do a little bit of negotiation. The person might say nothing, he's just being vile and beating me. At which point, by the way, when they say beating me, it's an example that they've probably collapsed the dissociation and getting back into it. Get them distant and say, so they're being violent, beating that child. Yes. Well, that's the behavior. So now, what do you think they're trying to achieve by that behavior? And they might say something like, oh, he's just being cruel. Do you really think he's being cruel? What's he trying to achieve? He must be trying to achieve something positive. He goes, oh, maybe, he wants to have peace of mind. Oh, so he wants to have peace of mind, and he thinks that by beating the child, he'll get it. Yeah. So then you get them to recognize the positive intention. In other words, so can you see that, you think it's worth for people, is it a good thing for people to want peace of mind? Sure. So you can understand that it's okay that, he wants something decent just to have peace of mind, but he's doing something really messed up to do that. Now the behavior is different. Yeah. Excellent. So now you've identified a positive intention, you've separated a behavior out of it. You may do a reframe along the lines of saying, the only reason they're behaving that way, being violent, is because they had other things going on in their life, they didn't know how to deal with it, and had they been, more together as people, had he had that father figure over there been wiser as a person, he would have realized that there are many different ways to get peace of mind, and that letting it all out on all their frustration out on his son really isn't, a good way of getting peace of mind. It's not going to achieve what he wants. It's just going to make matters worse, right? And you go, sure, I can understand that. Great. Now you have your basic leverage point. Assuming that the scene has other people, let's say that that someone else was present. Let's say it was the mother in the corner, just being quiet and not getting involved. You want to make sure that that person is also, their intentions in that scene is also being chunked up on. So her lack of involvement, also is motivated by some higher intention. It might be, for example, that she doesn't want to get involved because she's afraid that if she does, then it'll get worse. So she's trying to protect the son by not getting involved so that the beating isn't worse than it's going to be anyway. Right? That might be an example of it. It may be something else. You're always asking the person, the client, who had the experience to find the positive intention. And they will find one because all this is happening inside of their neurology. So there is a logical consistency that allows that splinter to remain. And you're looking for that logical consistency, that higher intention that drives that splinter part of them to be splintered off. So let's assume now you have all the problem anchors, you've done everything that can change personal history. You've done your dissociation. You have done your basic negotiation in terms of finding a positive intention for everybody involved in that scene, including the younger version of the client. Now it's time to get some resources. Now you remain in a dissociated position. You're looking up from space down at the building. You're in the cinema looking down at that little tiny little screen, black and white, whatever you need to do to make it less intense. And then you ask the client, from that dissociated position, what kind of resources does each person in the scene, taking one each one at a time, need in order to properly satisfy that positive intention? So let's say the kid wants to have love. What is a positive resource that they would have needed? Maybe it could have been, I don't know, the ability to express themselves with happiness, right? So maybe that they can approach to that rather than being approaching them with wariness, just with happiness. It could be just resilience, it just could be confidence. It could be any matter of things. So just find a resource that will help that child more. And it could be just to realize that he is loved, right? But it's the emotional experience rather than just understanding the child needs love, or perhaps the resource is to feel loved. So there the child, so you have that resource there. Then you do it with the father. So the father might have needed a resource. He wants peace of mind. Maybe peace of mind is the resource. Maybe understanding is. Understanding that he can't let it out on his son. Maybe that's the resource. Maybe it's a sense of understanding what he's actually doing to his son when he's hitting him, so that he treats him well rather than poorly. So resources can come in all kinds of shapes and sizes. It could be confidence, it could be feeling of love, it could be feeling of self-respect, it could be a sense of control in the rest of his life, right? So if the father felt that the rest of his life was in control, he wouldn't have felt frustrated, so he wouldn't have felt like he needs to let it out on the son, right? Doesn't matter. Whatever the resources are, you find something, a resource that each individual player in that scene, down there, over there, would have needed in order to, you know, for the scene to have worked out perfectly, worked out fine. So now you have a higher intention and you have a resource. Now, the first thing you do is you take the child or the younger version of the client in that scene. So first you find, you go back to the resource that they've identified for the child, let's say in this case is to be feel loved, and you use your normal revivification process to find love or a feeling of being loved in that person's life. You revivified, you intensified, and you anchor it. Okay? So you first find the resource anywhere. So you might say, so you know, as you're looking down that scene as an adult right now, you realize, of course, that there are many times in your life where you felt totally loved. And go, sure. As an example, can you give me an example of what comes to mind right now when you think about feeling totally loved? Oh, you know, my first girlfriend, you know, we're on a sailing holiday, we did this and that. And you go, oh, great, so you're on a sailing holiday and you felt totally loved. You go, sure. You've built that up. Now you anchor that resource of feeling totally loved. So now it's time to do a kind of collapse anchors in the scene for the child. So what you do is you get the person to project that love into the child. So they're feeling that love now. As you're feeling that sense of love, just allow that child down there, that younger version of you, to feel that love as well, as full as you do right now. And notice how the scene unfolds differently now. So now the scene unfolds with that child in a positive glow of love, right? So running through the whole scene again, still dissociated, still in the back of the cinema, still looking down from outer space or wherever they were. But this time, the child down there has whatever resource it needed, in this case, love. And you notice any changes that occur. It may be no changes in terms of behavior, but the child doesn't feel like so bad at the end of it. It may be changes in terms of maybe the father just doesn't do anything anymore. Maybe the scene just freezes and refuses to move forward because the father can't really do any beating and the child is feeling a positive glow of love. Perfect. It's all good. So now that you've anchored that resource, the feeling of love, into the child from that dissociated point of view, you're going to take one of the other players, in this case, the father figure, and you do the same thing. You're going to find a resource for them. Let's say it's the sense of feeling control in life. And you're going to find a sense of resource and say, well, you know, you felt in control of your life in times in the past. Go, sure. You know, when I was a university student and I just finished my final exams, I felt on the top of the world, like I could conquer anything, do anything I wanted. You know, I had my diploma and I managed it and I was in, you know, I felt in control. So now, you know, that's a great feeling to have and it's great for people to feel in control that way. Yeah. So how do you think your father would have been different had he felt that same sort of control in that situation back then down there? I don't know. Well, why don't you find out? Project that sense of control onto that father. And again, you're running through that scene now with the father having that sense of being in control. The person is still dissociated, so they're still watching a movie in the back of the movie theater. Only down there in the movie itself, you have a little kid that's feeling totally loved, and you have a father now that's feeling totally in control. Now, at this point, the film will run in a totally different direction. It has to, because the needs are different, the intentions are being satisfied, and they're resourceful. So chances are, they may well burst into tears at this point, because they'll see something charming like, you know, kid comes in and bugs father, father puts his paper down, picks him up in his lap, and starts chatting to him, and they start playing games and having a great time. So this is now a spontaneous change of personal history going on here based on that. You do the same thing for any other players. Let's say that the mother is involved also. She's sitting quiet in the corner. Let's say her resource is the courage, the conviction sense of conviction to protect her son. You activate the resource, you get her that sense of conviction, she stands up and she, intervenes as well and protects the son, and everyone's, again, is a happy ending at the end of it. So now you've run through that same scene, for each individual player in that scene, making sure that each individual player has the resource they needed, and then you have basically now everyone who is in that scene, child, mother, father figure, all with the resources, all running through that scene, and the scene, of course, evolves. There are changes that are happening. Okay? So you've taken each person in turn so far. Let's pause at that point for a moment and let's see if you have any questions or comments on what we've done so far. We haven't finished the process yet. It's quite involved, it's quite technical, so I just want to make sure that you follow up to this point. Any comments or questions on what we've done there?
No, I think I'm following along okay.
Okay. So, just to recap, we've started off like a changed personal history. We've anchored all the different times in the past that they felt this badly. We've gone back to the first time. That's the imprint event, the earliest moment. We dissociate them by getting to float up into the back of the room, back of a cinema, out of space somewhere looking down, anything so they get some distance. Then we found the intention. We found the intention of the child, we found the intention of the father, we found the intention of the mother. Always a positive intention. What's driving this behavior? What are they trying to achieve that's positive? It's in this sense, it's love, it's a sense of control, and it's a sense of protection. You want to protect someone. Then we've gone through and we've identified resources for everyone. The kid needs love, the father needs a sense of feeling in control, the mother needs a sense of conviction that she can protect her child in a different way. Then you run through the scenes individually. In other words, three times there's three players, five times there's five players, each time focusing on one of the players and making sure that that player has the resources you've just identified for them. So the child runs through the scene with the child having love, you run through the scene with the father feeling in control, and with the mother having a sense of conviction. So now you've run through the scene, twice, three times, however many people are there. Each time with a resource, each time still dissociated, so you're still watching it from the back of the cinema as though you're watching a film. And that's the point we've reached so far. Now comes a very important part of the process. Now comes the association. So far, you've been dissociated. You've been distanced from it. You've been dispassionate, just watching other people doing stuff, like a cinema screen. Now you have to re-experience the event from the point of view of each one of the players with the resources. So make sure that you've anchored all those resources so that you can fire them off at the right time. So we're going to start off from the point of view of the child. You're going to get the person to float back out into the cinema screen, step into the child, so seeing things from the child's point of view, but this time taking with them the resource, in other words, feeling love. And they're feeling love, the father's feeling in control, and the mother is feeling secure and in protection and protective, right? So you run through that whole scene, and they're experiencing it from the first point of view. Then they float out, and they float into the father figure, and they run through the whole scene again. This time from the point of view of the father, feeling in control. So they now see them, say they see their younger self coming up to them, bugging them, but they're feeling in control, so they put their paper down, they play with them, and it's all, happy, happy, clappy. You do it again, this time from the mother's point of view. And this time with the mother having all their resources she needs. In other words, the sense of conviction that she wants to protect her child. So now she looks over there and she sees her little son and all the feelings she feels towards him and how she's protective. And, everything works out well and she gets up and she protects him. Or maybe the father starts raising an eyebrow and she says, don't even think about it. It'll happen spontaneously differently to different people. The point is, they're running through it from the mother's point of view now, inside the mother. With the resources. So now they've been inside themselves with the resources, inside the father with the resources, inside the mother with the resources. Or, of course, if there's other players, if it's a school scene, it'll be the teacher, the other kids, etc. But you've gone through every single person in that scene. You've run through it all. At this point, you are pretty much done. You've had a tremendous breakthrough. You have run through the whole scene from all those points of view, and you bring them back to the present moment, so you reorient them back to here and now, And you break their state, you distract their attention again. So they're back here, you give them a few moments to kind of like integrate what's happened, and they come back. Typically they will be a little bleary-eyed, might be a little bit emotional, in a positive sense. And you distract their attention, maybe chat about whatever. Now you test it. How do you test it? You casually ask them about the situation that was a problem in step one. Remember the first step, the problem was that they felt useless or unworthy or worthless as an individual. And maybe the context for that problem would have been that they felt, useless or worthless when they go up to the boss to ask for a raise. So notice how the feelings of being worthless had nothing to do in terms of the situation with the initial imprint event. It just has a negative impact on the future anyway. So you just casually ask them about the situation. So, as you think about going to, to your boss, ask for a raise, what happens now? Oh, I feel great. I've got all these different things, and I can tell them about all the stuff I've done. It's fantastic. So you're basically noticing the natural response about the past event that they came with a problem. And then, of course, you do your future pace just as before. Future pace them to many different future scenarios, and each time to let them notice what happens spontaneously so that they can rehearse feeling worthwhile, feeling loved, and doing all the behaviors that go with that in future scenarios, which, had they happened in the past, would have left them feeling worthless, but now they're feeling more loved, more empowered, more animated, etc. And then you're pretty much done. So, do you understand the idea of the re-imprint method? Okay. So, any questions or comments about that method? It's quite involved, I know. There's a lot of steps, but if you take each step individually, this is why we started with the change personal history. It's just a change personal history with what's called a parts negotiation added into it. Does all that make sense?
Yeah, it does. How would you go about deciding which one to use with a specific client?
Well, partly it's just gut instinct. You'll try one with one client once and it doesn't work, so you switch to something else and eventually it works. And over a period of time, you will basically have developed a sensitivity for what kind of things work, right? That's one way of doing it. The other thing is to realize that certain things, will become preloaded with different likelihoods of working. So in a sliding scale of difficulty, we've basically gone through a sliding scale of difficulty up to this point in terms of how big the problem is. So if it's a small problem, like they get a little upset when someone says nasty things, I might just do a collapse anchors. If it seems that they can't collapse the resource properly, and I've tried restacking it up and it doesn't work, I might move on to chaining anchors. Then if that doesn't seem to be enough, I may or if in the conversation during the meta model they keep referring back to their past and saying, this happened to me, it's always happened to me, like when it happened to me here and happened to me there and happened to me there. If they keep referring back to the past, then I know I'm gonna have to do either a change personal history or a re-imprint, depending on how intense the past was, right? If the past is not too intense, I'm gonna try the change personal history. If it's intense, but I still think I have a sense that I can do a collapse anchors in each of the events, I'll just do a collapse anchors and do a change personal history. If I'm doing the change personal history, but it just isn't taking, right? It just isn't working out. I'm trying to do the collapse anchors, but they keep coming up, but this, but that, and it doesn't work out, there's so much missing. In other words, they keep coming up with excuses, they keep coming up with reasons why it can't work, they keep coming up with, this is bad or this is indifferent or whatever. It's basically telling me that there's other stuff that needs to happen. And whilst I could technically do it with the collapse anchors, if I'm setting it up carefully with good reframes, the re-imprint method is basically a change personal history with a heavy dose of reframing added in. And the reframing comes in the form of this parts negotiation that we've been talking about. So if I'm trying to do a change personal history, but it's not taking, I'll probably switch smoothly straight into a re-imprint method, because it's basically telling me that they need a heavier reframe than the simple collapse anchors will allow them to do. And that's what the re-imprint method does, very meticulously and very carefully. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does, thanks.
Okay. So do you have a sense of how to use those various anchoring techniques in terms of solving different problems, helping different people overcome different situations?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Okay. So now let's turn to the final anchoring technique that I want to cover as an official anchoring technique. And this one's a lot of fun. It's not so much a collapse anchors, it's actually it's a form of a simple anchor. You may have come across it. There's a couple of famous motivational speakers that love using techniques like this. And it's basically called Circle of Excellence. It's a great fun technique to do. When I do NLP practitioner programs, I always do this one, and then the group have a great time, because basically it's a way of building into people powerful resource anchors that they can take with them wherever they need. So imagine you have the ability to walk into any meeting and feel like $1 million walking in, and the more important it was, the better you would feel. Imagine that you have that at your beck and call wherever you want to, whether it's a meeting, whether you have to be more alert and ready when you go into an exam, whether you have a hot date coming up and you want to feel, you know, top of the world. No matter what life faces you, imagine you have that resource ready to hand anytime you wanted to. Well, this is what the Circle of Excellence does for you. The Circle of Excellence is basically, it's a simple anchor. You can do this by yourself, but it's a lot easier if someone else takes you through it, because of course they can take you through ABS. In other words, they can help you bypass critical thinking and take you through steps, so you just get to enjoy the process. But you can do it on yourself as well. And the Circle of Excellence basically is a way of feeling totally energized, totally positive, totally empowered whenever you want. The way you do this is that you identify a state of excellence. In other words, a moment in your life when you were on the top of the world, where you felt smart, you were lucid, you were clear thinking, you were full of energy, you were, you know, in tune with the world, whatever excellence means to you. So you find that you get someone to select a state like that, you elicit it, you amplify it, you know, you get a sense of what that is. Now, to install the Circle of Excellence, what you do is very simple. You get the person, your client, to imagine a circle out in front of them. Just imagine it on the floor, right? Just think about it or pretend it's there. If you want to, you can really draw it, but the imagination's better because they can take the imagination with them. Now, you're going to create a simple dissociation. You're going to say to them, just see yourself or imagine yourself standing, or think about yourself standing inside that circle, right? Now, a little note on visualization here. Some people think they can't make pictures inside their minds and say, oh, I can't see myself in it. I can't imagine that. I don't think they have an imagination. So just say to them, just think about, you know, consider that there's a metaphorical circle in front of you, and just think about yourself standing in there. You know, what would you be looking like if you stood in that circle over there, right? So you're using your language, and you're switching it from them seeing it or visualizing it to them just thinking about it. Because if they're thinking about it, they're still doing it, right? So just think of that circle over there. Think of yourself standing inside there. So you have a dissociation going on because they're outside the circle looking at themselves being inside the circle. Now the important thing is you now build up the resource, the state of excellence, inside the person, inside the circle. So not the person on the outside, it's the person on the inside. There's a nice little hypnotic ambiguity you can use there as well, by the way. So there's a circle, there's a person inside the circle. And you say, what would that person look like? How would you be breathing when you're feeling the state of empowered excellence? What would your facial expression be like when you're in the state? How would you be standing? How would your shoulder be angled? You know, how would you place your weight? So you just get them to look at themselves in that circle, being totally empowered, and just noticing all these little things: pupil dilations, colorations, their breathing rhythm, their shoulders, how they're hanging, how their posture is standing, all these different things. And all the time you're using your hypnotic language and your pace, you're building it up to really build up the sense of empowerment, the sense of what it's like to be in that resource. Now, as soon as they have really built up that person, so the person inside the circle has their resource really activated to its maximum, you get them to step inside the circle and associate to all those good things that they've projected up until that point. So you get them to feel the way they feel, breathe the way they were breathing, and feel inside their body. And then again, use your language like a sliding anchor to make it stronger and stronger. The longer they stand in that circle, the stronger it gets. Now, here comes the anchoring part. As they are feeling it, fully associated, they've stepped literally physically from where they were standing looking at the circle. They've now taken a step forward into the circle, and they've adopted the posture, the breathing, etc. They're feeling it. You can see their eyes lighting up, their face lighting up. Before that moment peaks, you get them to just step back outside of the circle. Actually, you can get them to do a gesture, or they can actually use the circle, doesn't matter. Let's say they can make a gesture like a closed fist. So just as they are peaking that experience, you send them to close a fist and maybe say the word like yes or amazing or I can do it or whatever they want. And just as the feeling starts to fade, they step back out of the circle and let go of the clenched fist. So now the clenched fist and the word or whatever the anchor was going to be becomes their anchor for being able to get that state again. So the whole process was, you've identified a state, you've got them to think of a circle, think of themselves inside the circles, having all the wonderful side effects of that state. They then step into the circle, feel the feelings, they build them up, and just as it begins to peak, they make a gesture, which is the self-anchor. So it could be a fist, it could be a word like yes, it could be touching themselves in a certain way, it could be putting their fingers together in the meditation position, anything. Remember, unique stimulus. When it peaks, they let go of the anchor, they step back outside, they calm down a little bit again. Now you're going to go through a conditioning cycle. You're going to do this 3 to 5 times, the exact same process again. Each time they go back in, each time you build it up, they'll step back into the peak, they begin to feel inside themselves, you build it up, they make the same gesture, the same word, the same physical movement, whatever it is. And then again, they step back out. You do that 3 to 5 times, clearing the mind, breaking the state in between. Eventually, you just get them to think about a time in the future. You do a future pace and say, think of a time where this will be useful, maybe an interview, maybe an exam, something like that. And notice yourself just feeling great. And then you just get them to make that fist and basically feel that feeling as powerfully in front of them. Do you understand the basic concepts of how to install the circle of excellence in that way?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, now here's a very nice variation of this that I love doing with children. It's a really nice way of doing this, and actually, it works with a lot of adults as well, although you need to get a bit of their critical factor bypassed a bit more for this. Instead of using a physical anchor like the yes or the fist or the meditation fingers or whatever it is, instead of using that as the anchor, you're going to use the imagination as an anchor. And this is hugely versatile. So basically, you're going to say, there's a circle, you step in, and every time you step into that circle, you'll feel that. You do that, you condition that 3 or 4 times, so they have a conditioning cycle so that when they step into the circle, they feel that. Now you tell them to mentally move the circle somewhere else, and you do it again. So you move it from wherever it was in front of them, maybe to one side, and then you just step into it again. And you get it to the other side and step into it again. Now, soon you won't even have to bother with the build-up. So you're seeing themselves inside it. You just say, see the circle, step inside it, feel the feelings, right? So now that you've done the conditioning cycle, you just say, just move the circle to the left, see the circle, you see the circle, yes, step inside it, feel the feelings. Bam, it's there. Okay, now step back out. Now mentally move the circle somewhere else. Now step inside it, feel the feelings. You do that again 5, 6, 7 times, moving the circle each time. Right? Then get them to mentally pick up the circle, maybe figuratively put it inside their pocket or put it somewhere else so let it hover above themselves. And basically tell them every time they need to feel this good, they can just mentally whip out the circle, put it on the floor, and then as they walk through it, they'll be instantly empowered. You can do suggestions like, you can test yourself for the rest of the day. Whenever you walk through a doorway, just throw the circle out in front of you, and notice as you walk through it, it's like a refreshing shower of these empowering feelings of excellence. So using your hypnotic language to set it up. Now every time they walk through a doorway, they will throw that mentally throw that down that circle, they will walk through it and just be empowered and jazzed for it. It's a great way, by the way, to just spend a day just getting jazzed by walking through places. And it's a great thing to have because rather than having to make a curious gesture or say the word yes, which is sometimes inappropriate, you walk into an important meeting, someone asks you a tough question and you go, yes! Not necessarily the most useful response to give, right? But this is something you can do. You just, if you're in an important meeting, you just let the circle fall on top of you and you feel empowered. If you're walking into the meeting, you just throw the circle out in front of you, and as you walk through it, you just activate all those resources. Same is true of, interviews, meetings, special occasions, exams. It really doesn't matter what it is. As long as you take your imagination with you, which is going to go everywhere your mind goes, you have the ability to empower yourself using this variation. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, it does, yeah.
So do you have any questions on the Circle of Excellence?
No, that seems a bit more straightforward than the other ones, actually, the re-imprint one.
Absolutely. It's a very straightforward process. It's a lot of fun to do. And the reason I left it to the end is basically because whereas the other four techniques, collapse anchors, chaining anchors, change personal history, and re-imprint, whereas those are basically therapeutic techniques to overcome problems, and some pretty heavy-duty ones like re-imprint, the Circle of Excellence isn't about overcoming problems, it's just about having more out of life. It's just about being more as an individual, right? So it's an example of generative change rather than a remedial change. Remedial being, of course, you're remedying a problem. Generative change being about you're just generating better and better options into your life.